for the benefit of those that are watching on Gavel to Gavel and for the audience members here, I'm Vic Coring. I chair this committee, Oil and Gas. It's today is, what is today? Today is the 6th of February, 5th of February, thank you very much, at 1:03 p.m. And I thank everybody for attending here, including those that aren't on the committee that I wish to acknowledge as well. We've got Representative Seaton and Gatto, and of course we have a Representative Holm and Representative McGuire with us. We expect others to show up shortly. Now, Rookberg will not be able to be here due to a meeting with the governor. The intent in hearing these two bills is not to move the bills. It's just simply to have them initially presented to us, and then we will take testimony. I think it might be good, since there will likely be, and I fail to acknowledge Representative Stoltz. Thank you, Bill, for joining us. And I don't think there's any other legislators to acknowledge, so I think we're covered. But we're not going to move either bill. We're just going to hear the bill. It's just the initial step in this process of working on these two bills. And what I'd like to do is have Representative Harris's office, who has House Bill 420 or 395, to present the legislation. Then we will present the oil and gas bill. I've got my staff aide, Eric, to help with that. And then following that, we will take testimony, which will continue despite the 2 o'clock hour, where most of us are going to have to leave due to other commitments. But I will stick around, and anybody else is welcome to as well, of course, to hear the testimony, of which I expect to be substantial, but so far just two. So maybe that won't happen, but we'll see. So with that, we'll have Representative Harris's office present House Bill 395. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Wright, staff to Representative John Harris, one of the sponsors of the bill, and I'll get into that in just a moment. As you know, Mr. Chairman, throughout the summer there were many meetings held out through your area, through part of Representative Harris's area, the Palmer area, and in Homer, discussing coal bed methane. And when I went to the first meeting in Homer, you know, just to be upfront with the committee, I was a little skeptical, maybe a little cynical. You know, I was kind of expecting a group of people there that really did not want to see any development happen within their area or in their backyard. But after listening for over 4 hours to concerns that were expressed by the more than 300 people who were in attendance in that meeting, I came away with, you know, I wasn't skeptical anymore, because the concerns in my mind were very valid. And the concerns primarily were the lack of local government input that was available in coal bed methane discussions, the public notice requirements, concerns about drinking water contamination, and private property rights. Then later that fall, there were meetings held in the Homer area, which Representative Seaton may want to discuss with you, that expressed a number of the same concerns. We do believe that DNR did institute a good public policy process, but there were limitations and guideline or limitations under which they could actually go forth. And, you know, there were some concerns expressed about that as well. But, you know, I think DNR should be acknowledged and thanked for their efforts in getting the citizenship involved in this process. During the fall, Representatives Stoltz, Gatto, Seaton, and Representative Harris met and were discussing the various issues that I just brought forth, and to try to see if we could find solutions, you know, to the problems that were expressed to us. And the bill before the committee right now is an effort to discuss some of those issues. We did not include buyback. I know there's a number of people who want to see buyback happen in the Sutton area and the Homer area, but legislation has been introduced addressing this issue, and I think at this point in time, we just as soon see what's going to happen with that legislation and see where it's going to go before we start instituting buybacks into the process that we've developed thus far. I'd like to introduce Rick Vanderkolk, who is also from our office. Rick has worked a lot on this bill, and along with staffs of Representative Gatto, Representative Seaton, and Representative Stoltz, and one other person I think it should be acknowledged to really got me involved in this process, and that's Barbara Bitney, who was working for Representative Stoltz at the time. Put a lot of work into this effort, and though we know this is far from being a finished product, this was the result of our conversations and discussions, And again, Rick Vander Kolk is here. He can discuss the merits of House Bill 395 and also answer any questions about the legislation the committee members may have. And at this time, Mr. Chairman, with your acceptance, I'd like to turn it over to Rick.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mr. Wright. Rick, and before you start, just to acknowledge the committee members Hines and Curtula's presence, as well as our friend Mike Chenault. Thank you for joining us.
Mr. Chairman.
Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. And for the record, Rick Vander Kolk, Staff Representative Harris. I think Tom already covered the basic highlights of local property rights concerns, water quality assurance, integrity, and some of the aspects of public notice. I'd like to go over some of the sections that were amended, if we could. I know that there's a lot of testimony, possibly anyhow, so I'll try to keep it brief. Most time will be spent on the first section, which contains a water quality and integrity insurance in regards to hydraulic fracturing. For the record, even though most members are probably aware of it, hydraulic fracturing is a technique used by the oil and gas industry to improve the production efficiency of production wells, including CBM production wells. Hydraulically created fracture acts as a conduit in the rock or coal formation that allows the oil or gas to travel more freely from the rock pores. To create such a fracture, a viscous, water-based fluid is sometimes pumped into the coal seam under high pressures until a fracture is created. These fluids consist primarily of water, but in some cases they contain other various additives. Diesel fuel is one of those additives. There are at least three arguments for establishing this section. If you look at Section 1 there, we have the addition that adds to the authority of the AOGCC the ability to regulate hydraulic fracturing associated with exploration for and recovery of shallow natural gas to assure that reinjected water does not contaminate supplies of drinking water or water for agricultural purposes. And basically what we're looking at is we have a great deal of public concern about this regarding the quality of their water. Secondly, it conforms well with recent case law, and I'll direct you to an exhibit that was passed out as an additional handout to your packet. Hopefully you have it there, regarding a Ninth District decision from middle of last year. Basically, that sets the tone for allowing states to regulate the CBM operations, how water is handled, and allows, you can go through it, it's rather lengthy, so there, see that in front of you?
Mr. Chairman, just so that members can see, it's the front of it's titled a memorandum of agreement, and then you have to go back inside approximately halfway until you get to the case. Northern Plains Resource Council.
Thank you, Representative McGuire. Go ahead, Mike.
And so in that decision, a three-member circuit panel unanimously concluded that the water from the coal bed methane operation is a pollutant even if unaltered. They go on to say that rejected application of an earlier decision that emission of biological waste involving farm shellfish operations is not a discharge of pollutants as applicable precedent. Instead, the court declared the water, salty when discharged, was an unwanted byproduct of the coal bed methane extraction process, that it was produced water that could qualify for a Clean Water Act permit discharge exemption only if disposed of underground. And so there is our precedent, and I think it's something that's relatively recent since it took place in our minds almost a year. I think this committee dealt with HB 69, and now this is more appropriate for us to look at that case. The third element is it enshrines a good business practice. Another handout for you to that in a moment here, a memorandum of agreement between three companies and the EPA. And basically what's happened here is that these have a voluntary agreement. They will no longer use diesel fuel and hydraulic fracturing fluids injected into CBM production wells for any of the water tables. And I think that's extremely important because you're setting kind of a business practice precedent, if you will, for some a model for others to follow. They recognize that it's a sensitive issue and that mountains of litigation are possible. And so rather than hashing it out that way, they assumed it was better to enter a voluntary agreement. So if we move on then to some other sections, because there's quite a bit to deal here, and we'll just be brief with them. The first point, over the past several months, there have been hundreds of residents attending local meetings voicing concern of potential impact, as you've heard. On the second, in the case law, we'll summarize the discharge of water must be separated from surrounding water table through reinjection, which this amendment does. On the third part, public participation is a necessary part put in that memorandum of agreement. In Section 2, in conjunction with shallow natural gas exploration and recovery, a new provision directing the AOGCC to initiate a public forum process to informally resolve issues of public health, safety, welfare, and environment, and complaints. This is where we initiate a public forum in sections 2 and 4. That's been one of the long-term complaints from many residents that it's not very lengthy, it's not very thorough. They'd like an opportunity to have a lecture from the, both the company and explanation without trying to delay the leasing process. Moving on to sections 3 and 9, and 6 for that matter, we standardized and defined what we mean by shallow natural gas lease, the leasing process within 3,000 feet. They eliminate in the respective definitions of shallow natural gas the reference to recovery of natural gas from a depth of up to 4,000 feet and replace it with a reference to 3,000. In section 5, we're amending 3805-177 part F to add a series of additional requirements. It must be inserted in a national, and in a shallow natural gas lease to include, as in paragraph 2, required payments of fees by a lessee to an owner. Third, setbacks applicable to compressor stations that are appropriate to the lease. Fourth, appropriate noise mitigation measures. And fifth, surface restoration requirements, if that is, if the surface is disturbed by exploration or development of operations. In section 7, in instances in which an owner and a lessee cannot reach agreement, we've provided a clause here for reasonable access. If they can't reach agreement on the latter's entry onto property to explore and develop shallow natural gas in the lease, seeks to post a bond to permit entry, the amendment adds a further requirement that the lessee demonstrate the access and entry upon the land of the owner is reasonable, necessary, or convenient to secure the lessee's rights. And basically, this is going to show justification for the lessee's proposal. Section 8, language in subsection P, expands upon the procedures currently applicable to securing protection against damages insofar as those procedures relate to shallow natural gas exploration and development activities. Section 10 and 11, amendments to 3105-125 and statutes 3805-177 Part N, were added in 2003, authorized the Commissioner of Natural Resources to approve a waiver of local planning authority approval and requirements relating to compliance with local ordinances and regulations if the DNR clearly demonstrates an overriding state interest. Those provisions are proposed for repeal in this bill. And that's the gist of the summary, and pleased to take any questions, and I can go over some more parts. We've got some more background material, but there's an awful lot there if you want to get into the background. So.
Thank you very much, Rick. Yes, Mr. Wright.
To Representative Scott and Cito, or Gatto, Seaton, almost mixed the names up here, and Stoltz are here. And, you know, we all have specific parts of this bill, and I would refer, if there are questions, you know, regarding, you know, certain aspects that we defer to them as well.
Okay. And you gentlemen are welcome to join in the conversation and offer any comments that you have on this legislation. Do you have any at this point, Commissioner Sherman? Not to put you on the spot, but if not, when something comes along, please feel free.
Thank you. Thank you for your early attention to this. And so obviously, you know the concerns of the communities that district lines don't mean a lot in the part of the valley that we represent. There's always a community that's trying to respond to legitimate concerns. I appreciate you getting this early in the session.
Welcome. Any questions from members of the committee or members of the legislature that are our guests here today? Representative Seaton, do you have something?
Yes, I appreciate your attention to this. I would like to say that these are corrective actions that we're trying to take. What has happened is the shallow natural gas regulation went forward under one set of ideas, that is rural development, shallow in nature, and what has happened with very streamlined regulation. I mean, extremely streamlined. And at the time, the thought was that these were going to be small wells that were going to be water drilling kind of rigs that would be in place for less than a week on a pad. And what has happened is that this has morphed beyond what anyone really intended. There was actually the language as it came out was turned out that DNR was not able to consider public comments on the that were offered by statute. And you know, DNR was not happy about that, as, and no one else was. You know, there's unintended consequences. It also, the reason we are putting back in the 3,000 feet is because what is happening in the Homer area is this is turning into a conventional gas play, not water well-sized rigs, but full-blown rigs to full depth if anything can be shown to exist above 3,000 feet. And could these large rigs could be in place for extended periods of time with directional drilling, et cetera. So what has happened is that what we're trying to do is get back with these provisions so that the best interest of the state is, again, considered. And we're not saying that anyone intended to make this happen, but it was an unintended consequence of looking at a rural situation and trying to develop energy sources and then having that applied in urban areas. And that's been the frustration that's come forward. Thank you,
Representative Seaton. Representative Hines, do you have a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to have a lot, but right now, I think the only one I would have is, and I'm trying to find where you read this, Lisi, is the reasonable justification to cross someone's land. I just heard that in passing, and I'm trying to find it. Do you know what part that
through,
is in?
Through the Chair, Representative Hines, in Section 7, referring to.
Okay. I guess I'm getting at what, how do we define reasonable?
Representative Seaton has something on that.
Chairman. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is trying to get some balance back in the situation here. This is relating to a surety bond. If there is a lease and a surface holder who is not the subsurface holder, and we've leased the subsurface rights, there is supposed to be a surface use agreement. The way it works right now is if the surface holder and the subsurface right holder can't come to an agreement, the subsurface right holder goes to the commissioner of DNR, and the commissioner of DNR's only ability is to say, okay, what absolute damages are going to be by drilling in this person's front yard or their backyard or in the schoolyard or wherever this drilling happens to be, and posting a bond for the physical damage that would occur in the rehabilitation of that piece of property. What isn't related here is it necessary for the company to use that person's front yard when there's 15 acres of undeveloped land sitting right next to it? So what this does is come, it's at the Commissioner DNR, the leaseholder, that's the oil leaseholder, has to just demonstrate to the commissioner that it's reasonably necessary or convenient for him to use that particular piece of ground to put his drilling rig or his compressor station on, and that there aren't other reasonable sources. And this language is taken right out of the current statute. But what it does, it gives DNR commissioners some flexibility to weigh and consider the surface use and the subsurface rights. Now, obviously, state law and the Constitution allows for the subsurface right has precedence. But what this does is brings it back to DNR so that they can balance and say, okay, do you need this particular piece of ground for access to the subsurface rights that we've given you? And that's the criteria of reasonably necessary and convenient. And that's all that they have to, that's all that the mineral right holder would have to show to DNR commissioner, and then the surety bond would be leaked. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know in the past we've had DNR commissions that were friendly to development, and then we've had those that weren't. So it kind of puts it in a precarious balance if there is, I guess, a standing off of who's on first, then boy, that's a lot of power to put in one person's hands. And depending on their point of view,
Representative Seaton and then Stoltz.
Mr. Chairman, we didn't want to bring this out and try to balance weights. What we did want to do is give some discretion to the Commissioner of DNR to consider whether it's reasonable and necessary for them to use that particular piece of property. And so this just throws in some consideration. And the Commissioner of DNR, whose responsibility is for developing our natural resources, is going to do that. But like I say, you know, you might have a piece of ground and you might have a canyon and acreage on the other side of that ground that's available. Well, it would be very inconvenient for the oil company or gas company to come in and have to cross a canyon to do that. So I would presume DNR would say, no, you've shown me that it's reasonably necessary and convenient for you to use this person's front yard. But it could also be the situation in which you have many blank pieces of property around, and for some reason, a driller, not the ones that we know right now, because the ones that we know right now are fairly responsible, could come in and say, I want to put it in your front yard. And just because I want to put it there, and the way the law is written right now, the Commissioner of DNR doesn't have any, all he does is say, well, the rehabilitation amount for having that in your front yard is going to be this, the surety bond, and you have absolute right to put it there without any consideration to the property owner.
Troubles me.
Representative Jula?
Thanks. And I assume we're going to get a chance to talk back to the sponsors after we've heard all the testimony.
Well, time is, Representative Cotullo, very limited today. At a follow-up meeting, absolutely.
Great. But I do have a question just on this point. I'm just not familiar with this, the term of art with reasonably necessary or convenient. And my concern is it's not and convenient, it's or convenient. So I just don't know how convenient gets applied. So at some point, I'd just like to see how that's interpreted, because it kind of is pretty broad if it's just convenient.
Thank you very much. I wanted to point out something, too. We want to be careful that any legislation we move out of this committee, it doesn't end up hindering the industry. Obviously, we want to make sure there's adequate protections for the private property owners, and that's my goal, I'm sure, of everybody here. But we accomplished a lot with House Bill 69, I thought, last year in terms of a streamlining of the permitting process, which was and that was to encourage resource development. And so as opposed to rolling back what we did, I'd like to just look at this whole effort here as a way to add protections. That's just my perspective anyway, and I know there's different philosophies and opinions out there as to how we should best handle this, but I just want to note that we, in my opinion, should exercise some caution that we're not too overzealous in trying to pass legislation that's going to do more to hamper the development of our resources, which I think most of us would like to see in the state of Alaska. Any other questions for the sponsors before we move on to the next piece of legislation and then move into the testimony? Apparently none. So what I'd like to do is thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony.
You.
I do appreciate it. We look forward to continue working with you on this issue. And at this time, I'm going to present legislation that is being brought forth by the Oil and Gas Committee. That's the second in our package here. And I wanted to reiterate for those that have shown up since the start of the meeting here that the intent is to present both bills, get them out on the table, and then we'll move into public testimony, and we will adjourn the meeting upon the completion of that testimony. For those that have to leave, most of which will have to do so by 2 o'clock for other meetings, that is okay. I will continue to hear the testimony so we can get through all of it. And then we will take up these bills at a subsequent meeting. And I also want to note that the tentative plan is to roll these two bills together. There's I think, good provisions in both pieces of legislation. And just move forth out of this committee with one bill ultimately. I've already consulted with the sponsor of the bill, and he's amenable to that suggestion. And that's likely what we'll end up doing here in the near future before we move the bill out. So we'll move into House Bill 420, offered by the Oil and Gas Committee. I'd like to call my staff aide, Eric Muster, to the table. And what I'm going to do is to present this legislation just conceptually, and then you might want to add a few comments if necessary to plug any holes, and then we'll open up for questions and then move to testimony from there. Now, this legislation is also in response to concerns that we've heard out there. Again, it's not to undo anything, it's to add additional protections. This one emphasizes the issue of water concerns, and one of the big concerns we heard in our testimony we took back home in all of our town meetings and from all our correspondents was that coal bed methane drilling could have a negative effect on waters in terms of depleting water sources. And it was the contention of the industry, and I frankly
felt there was a lot of validity to what they were saying, that given the depths of most coal bed methane drilling, it would not affect the water quality or quantity, most likely. Anything can happen, and there's no fail-proof system out there. Nothing's perfect, and there's always exceptions. But recognizing that there are concerns out there as far as what will happen if coal bed methane occurs in terms of water supplies, we offer this legislation here to address that, and it basically establishes a water well fund. In the event that coal bed methane drilling, and this is all preliminary, and we can certainly make tweaks here as far as the specifics in here as time goes by, but in the event that if any drilling occurs that's within 1,500 feet of any water well, and it causes that water well to be compromised, it causes it to go dry or whatever, that a claim could be filed by the affected property owner and have a replacement well paid for as a result of this fund. And the fund is drawn on a 1 cent charge per 20
million
MCF.
Yes, sir.
MCF.
And monies are generated from that. It's capped at $250,000 per drilling operation. And we don't want to make it sound like we're penalizing industry. We're not here to say that we want to impose fees. And with that in mind, what we're saying here with this legislation is that a refund would be afforded the driller once drilling and production has occurred and reclamation has taken place. They would apply to the state for a refund. They would get that money back. So if all goes as we expect and there's no compromise to the water, then the driller gets their monies back. So it's kind of a win-win situation. There's protection for the property owners, but also the driller is not going to be discouraged from drilling because they'll be confident they'll get their money back in time. Mr. Muster, would you care to add anything to this? Do you have any further thoughts, further points to make?
Mr. Chairman, through the committee, I know your points are right on. Although we'd like to do that, it's important to get in to the bill. Is there's one amendment necessary that clarifies how that exaction fee is calculated, and that's on page 3, line 7. The legislation reads that the exaction will be 1 cent per 20 million cubic feet, and amendment number 1 is offered. Because that calculation, it should say 20 MCF, okay, or 1,000. The unit of measure is 1,000, not millions. So
it was just a technical error in the production of this legislation.
Yes, sir.
So we would like to make that correction. Is there a member that would wish to offer that that amendment?
I move amendment number 1.
Any objection to amendment number 1? Hearing none, that is adopted. Thank you very much. There it is.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you. What that does, and only to clarify it, is while this 1 cent per MCF, it seems small, it's the position that we have responsible developers that are not going to cause degradation or harm to activity or to an owner's premises. So what the Department of Revenue, I believe, is standing by. What this fee will do is calculate to about $29,000 a year would accrue into this fund. So to reach the cap, it would take approximately 8 to 9 years, assuming roughly in a geographic point about 800 producing wells. And then will result in the cap, you know, being achieved in about 8 years. And that model, that of course is modeled from the old, it was an old producer exaction fee lever. It was a nickel a barrel fee that existed for several years in case of certain adverse conditions. That in essence is the major components of the
Thank
bill.
Thank you very much, sir. Any questions from committee members? Representative McGuire, Holm, and then Seaton.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to understand is, isn't the shallow gas company required to post a bond? Don't they post a bond? And if so, I think that's my understanding. Why is this necessary? I guess I'm trying to understand. My understanding is that it rarely occurs, and on the occasion that I know of that it did, at least with Evergreen, replaced, and so I'm just trying to understand how is it necessary if bonding is already required.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGuire, to respond to that, during the public testimony that was heard throughout the valley last year and through the fall, that one of the biggest concerns of residents that existed was, while it is correct we require a bond for activities on the drilling, the residents are forced into seeking other redress, hiring legal counsel, going after the bond, having lengthy delays to replace a well. What this legislation does is it precludes those obstacles. There's a presumed liability provision in the bill. So basically, if a permit is obtained by a company, this bill requires them to give you 30 days notice before entering your premises. When you receive that notice, the owner would have the responsibility of testing the well, saying, "I've got a well. This is my water supply. It flows at 16 gallons a minute, 15 gallons a minute, or what have you." Once those activities commence, if 2, 3, 4, 6 months later something happens and that well goes dry, this legislation allows a direct vehicle, provided they've tested the well. My well works. You know, here's the test. It's got to be replaced, and it can be replaced, and remuneration can be had by the property owner immediately rather than through legal redress.
And then just one follow-up, sorry.
No problem.
I admit, I mean, I think we're all been really busy today and so on, so it may be someone here that I don't see. How does the proof come into effect then? How do you prove that it was on account of the drilling activities that your well went bad? Is there somebody from DNR that comes out, tests it, or how does that work? Or is it just simply assume that if your well goes bad and they're drilling on the property and it was good before, as you said, they tested that it must be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGuire, to respond to that. It is presumed that if within 1,500 feet of your existing well, after activities commence, it is presumed to be probably caused from that activity, and your well would be replaced.
Thank you very much. Representative McGuire, are you finished?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. And next we've got Representative Holm, followed by Seaton, Hines, and then Gatto. Do you have a comment to make to that point briefly?
Right. Okay. That's a very difficult determination. If a well goes bad because the pump went out, certainly wouldn't want to count that against the driller. If a well went bad following an earthquake, would that count against the driller again? If a well went bad because water seems to be half the volume it used to be, would that count against the driller? I guess I could come up with one or two more, but some of these things are very difficult to determine. If a well went dry, I think we probably got something to say. But there are lots of things in a well that just aren't as good as they were a while back. Is there a way, or have we considered a way, or an arbitrator, or does the owner of the property need a well log prior to your entry to determine the depth and the volume that it produced and the strata as it went down to fix the quality of the well prior? I guess I'm searching for a way to determine accountability here. Have we considered that or not yet?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, certain components of that have been considered. This legislation is for replacement. For instance, certainly if your pump went bad or your pressure tank went bad or something, no, there are no provisions in this bill that would govern that type of situation. Neither is there a provision in the legislation in the event of a natural catastrophe, such as an earthquake. This addresses specifically if your well goes dry after the startup of activities and you have tested your well, and in terms of flow, quantity, and quality. That is it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess we also want to make sure a homeowner has a water quality report that identifies the hardness, the chemicals, the iron, whether or not there's contaminants such as arsenic and some other ones that are there. So I guess what we need to do is at least advise the well owner within that certain distance of the drilling area that it would behoove them to get their own baseline. Or does the company want to supply the baseline? Not that I'm asking for that, but I want to know what the arrangements are before we start asking that person to buy testing a service.
Through the chair, Representative Gatta, this legislation on page 2, lines 17 through 19, we require a landowner to receive notice, written notice, that activities will take place at least within 30 days. We require the owner to test the well in terms of both purity, form, and flow within that period. And then it is that baseline then that establishes those and answers those questions. Sir.
Thank you very much. We'll go to Representative Holm. I know Representative Friel has a question, but Holm and Seaton have been waiting very patiently, so we'll go to them first.
Thank you very much. Before I ask my question with regards to that, I want to go back to one thing. Amendment number one, I just want to make it perfectly clear that it removes the 20. Is it penny per 20 million cubic feet?
Through the chair, yes. No, it does not remove the 20. It only essentially removes the million, replaces the million with MCF per day.
Okay, so it still is a penny for every 20 million cubic feet per day?
Yes. Well, it meets the MCF as a unit measure is 1,000.
1,000 cubic
feet per
day. I just wanted to make perfectly clear where you had it, that I knew what I was talking about here. Okay. Back on this other issue with regards to the wells, I'm curious as to why, and I guess somebody could make a point here, but we have a company that comes into the state that wants to drill for shallow gas, and we all want them to do that. Property owner, I'm just to see if I follow this to its logical conclusion. They come in with the state saying, you don't own the subsurface rights, we're going to come in and get the gas, and we want you to participate in that, but we're not going to pay you for that. We want you to test your well. You come back to us with the assurances that the flow rates are right and everything, and therefore, if there's a change after we drill, you have substantive proof that something's changed. Now, my question to you is why wouldn't we, if we're going to be drilling within 1,500 feet of, or some drilling company is doing that, why wouldn't we make that a requirement that the drilling company pay for water quality tests of any wells owned by people within 1,500 feet? Why don't we make it a condition of that rather than putting the condition on the people that are going to be possibly hurt by this problem?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that specific issue is one that is the wishes of the body, both the committee and the body. From listening to the testimony and listening to the concerns and through asking questions, the majority of folks out there that have wells test them periodically anyway. In the Homer area, in the Lower Peninsula, the petroleum nature of and substances in the water, the iron are so heavy, folks in that area test rather frequently and have had the result of cisterns in many areas. In the valley, the same situations occur. And so we felt that as it's a prudent homeowner responsibility to maintain your own equipment, maintain your own well, and to periodically test it in terms of changing that dynamic as it relates to this legislation, that's 100% the wishes of the body and the direction of how they want to go.
Certainly an option we can consider, Jim.
Thank you. I just didn't know if you'd thought about it before. It's one of those issues that I wonder if we've taken away the subsurface rights for the people of Alaska. It seems to me it would only make some sense that if we were going to go in next to their property that we would take a positive approach there.
And I want to make it clear for the record that we, as a legislature in this era, have not taken away those subsurface rights. I know what you mean, Jim, but I want to clarify that was the result of stated act and constitution at the onset of the history of our state many, many years ago. So we are bound by that. It has created some problems for us. I personally would like to see subsurface rights granted, just a personal opinion, but that would obviously be a major undertaking and result in the change of the Constitution and open a major can of worms. I want to make it clear that
lower permanent funding.
We did not do that, nor was that even an issue with House Bill 69 last year. We'll move to, thank you very much, Representative Holm. We'll move to Seaton, Hines, and then Kurtula.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to comment and ask a question here. I had the same concerns on the wells, and this is as if it's regular maintenance. This is meaning that every property owner that has a well or uses any surface water is going to have to, within 30 days of the notification, go out and get special testing. And I don't know of anyone who does flow testing on their well. Somebody may take a water quality test to find out if there's bacterial contamination, but water purity maintains testing records and flow. That's not a normal well kind of log that any residential owner that I know of does. So I would just bring that to the attention. And the other thing is that I'm a little curious. The 1,500 foot, as I understand the coal bed methane, we would be looking at probably 4 wells per square mile. And 1,500 foot is basically a third of a mile. So that means if you had leasing in the Mat-Su area and you had the well spacing that is suggested by the companies, every single person in the valley that is within that lease area where the development takes place would have to test their wells. So you are talking about a significant amount of cost that you are putting upon the surface owner for them to be ever able to claim damages. And so I just want to put that forward that I'm not sure that I'm agreeing with Mr. Holm, Representative Holm, that we might be looking at this would be better of a condition upon the lease than we are on the condition of the surface owner who's been living there.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Certainly will be keep that under advisement as this legislation evolves. And we appreciate your thoughts on that. Representative Hines, followed by Kurtula.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think we all need to be extraordinarily careful here. We have a very hot issue when you deal with people's drinking water. You know, that cuts to the heart of their being, their land, their everything. And if we, by even suggesting that we form a baseline, I think we're introducing an element of fear that possibly are these people going to come in and mess up their wells. So we've got to be careful how we craft that message that, yes, we want wells tested, and, yes, we want to make sure the people of Alaska and the companies that we're saying, here's our welcome mat, come to Alaska and put your headquarters here. So we've got, you know, sometimes we feel like the Lady of Justice holding two things, the people of Alaska and the companies we want. So I'm just saying let's be awfully careful how we put this in here that we don't inflame the folks that are already afraid, thinking, gosh, these people are going to come in and you need to establish a baseline because, boy, you know, well, here they go. I mean, you can see the PR return on that. So let's just be careful how we craft it.
Thank you very much. Representative Kurtula.
Thanks. Again, this just is something I think probably for later, but the standard that's set out on line 23 on page 2 is that the activities appear to be probable, and I've just never seen one like that. I mean, that's something that I just want to see how that's interpreted, what it means. I don't think it's probably in any law right now, but if it is, I just want to be sure we understand what that means.
Through the chair, Representative, we're addressing that. Actually, this language was taken from existing statute related to mining, surface mining activities in Title 27. It exists
How old
there.
Is that statute?
Yeah, it's old. It's been around.
Yeah, great. I'd just like to see some information on what it is.
I circled that also.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I want to point out that we just have a kind of an outline, and it's just a concept at this point. And
right.
That's the point
right.
I have in this meeting. And I've,
right.
we've got some very good points, and we want to incorporate as much of that as we can to make this a workable bill. But at the same time, not crossing over the line as far as the balance that we're trying to achieve in terms of encouraging development. And also to note one of my favorite individuals in the audience, I just want to recognize his presence, former Lieutenant Governor Red Boucher. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Boucher. Honored to have you here, sir.
It's good to see you at work, Don.
All right. Great to be here. We're all proud to be serving our
Chairman.
State.
Hey, I'm sorry.
Okay. And I'd like to note we only have 11 minutes to go before the 2 o'clock hour, at which time many of the committee members have other obligations, namely economic development, and we just lost our chair to that, which is understandable. And we appreciate her indulgence in working with us and coordinating this with her committee. So we'll continue with any remaining questions, and then at that point we'll do our testimony. And those who choose to stay to hear the testimony are welcome to join me, and we will be here for the duration until we get through everybody in this stack here, which appear to be about 20 people so far. Are there any further questions on this legislation? Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question, but I just I vice chair that committee, so I'll have to be leaving, and I just want to apologize to the folks in the audience or online. Mean no disrespect, and I look forward to continuing the dialogue.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Any other questions or comments?
No, but may I say the same thing?
I must say the same thing too, Mr. Chair.
No problem. I understand.
I do have a question, though.
Yes, sir.
My staff asked me a question. I don't know the answer to it. The process of drilling for cobalt methane, can you laterally drill with that as well? In other words, are we talking just about wells that go straight down and we don't, and then we put something in, we fracture as we go? Or can we go down and can we drill across this way and this way with that process? Do we know?
To the chair, Representative Holm. Actually, Mr. Ekstrom from Evergreen Resources is here.
Okay.
We
can find out later. Huh?
Okay. All
right.
He can find.
I'd say thank you.
Sorry, Jack.
Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Thank you very much. Through the chair, Representative Holm, the practice of horizontal drilling is gaining in its economic viability. It is not something that Evergreen Resources has done in the Raton Basin. Of all natural gas produced in the country. So it came on very, very rapidly, and a lot of mistakes were made at the front end that have been corrected as we've moved through time. This technology is being this horizontal drilling technology and drilling multiple wells from one pad is being done in western Colorado. We are beginning operations in western Colorado. It's really kind of a cutting edge thing that's being refined as we move through time. I'm very hopeful, but it's difficult to say if it would apply up here until we develop some kind of commerciality. So we would be using conventional technology and unconventional gas, whatever that means. I think that's from the outset, but I have high hopes for that technology.
Thank you very much. I am through the chair, Mr. Chairman. The only reason I brought it up, of course, has to do with the water quality. I mean, when you're speaking one well, it's one thing, but if you're speaking of one well that can go out this way, the 1,500 feet all of a sudden doesn't have much bearing, so I wasn't sure if what we were saying really made sense.
There's a lot of romance in that notion, isn't there?
Yeah, I would think so, yes.
And the upside of having a directional drilling, if I may just throw in a comment, is it would alleviate, I would think, any concern about drilling occurring in somebody's backyard, which I don't think is ever going to happen. I don't think DNR is ever going to issue a permit that would allow that or on a school grounds. I think that's been overblown a lot in this whole argument. But
Mr. Chairman, we've never
done
that.
Would create
we
more
have never done that, and we never will.
And I know you have. You've been very responsible, and I appreciate that. You've been a model company. But I think with directional drilling, that would actually greatly minimize that prospect. So,
yes, sir.
I'd like to acknowledge Representative Roquefort. Thank you for joining us, sir. Representative Gatto.
Just one question, Jack.
Almost.
Just go on the hook, Jack.
Do you have a competitor that's directional drilling? or is anyone else doing it for CBM?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, we do not have a competitor who does directional drilling in the Raton Basin where we operate. We view all natural gas producers ultimately as our competitors, friendly competitors in most cases, people with whom we join in common interests on many issues. It's a different kind of geologic or surface scenario that allows for that kind of technology. The particular geology where we operate is not conducive to the present horizontal drilling technology. It is less economic because we don't have surface use problems in the Raton Basin, and we drill these wells fairly quickly and fairly cheaply. They're drilled in about a day. There isn't any compelling reason for us to do that. In particularly ecologically sensitive areas, I can certainly see how that would be desirable. But as we have had no problems in the Raton Basin, we don't, and our economics are very strong the way we're doing it, we don't have a compelling reason to move to that technology. It would be pretty much a financial consideration rather than any other kind of consideration.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I wanted to back up for just a minute on the what we're talking about, the water wells and proving. I did want to say that I appreciate this whole idea, although who does the testing might be questioned, because what we were told down in Homer is that not only if, unless you've tested, but unless you have water rights. So everybody is having to go through and file for water rights on their wells, because even if you have tested your water, if you haven't filed for water rights, then there's no compensation. So this is a very definite improvement, because it's not requiring you to have filed for water rights for your personal wells. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. I failed to mention that, Mr. Engstrom, you don't have to come back up here. I want to thank you for your continued faith in Alaska and your desire to want to stay here, because I know there's been companies that have intended to invest in Alaska, including the Matsu, that were really literally driven out because they just didn't want to deal with all the criticisms and the uproar that occurred. So I want to thank you for your faith that you have in our state and for the monies you invested in Alaska and the Matsu Valley. Appreciate it. So, any additional questions before we move into our public testimony? Apparently we have no more, so we will open the public hearing. What I'm going to do for those that are on line that wish to testify, and in person if there are any, is to just have you address whichever legislation that you would like to address. And I think these bills are germane. They're both similar in nature to degrees, so I thought it'd be appropriate just to take the testimony as the folks have signed up, as I have them on my list here. And I think what I'd like to do is to take those online. Thank you very much, everybody who's attended the meeting, but who has to leave at this point. I appreciate your presence. But we'll start with the first individual on my list, which is Chris Whittington Evans, somebody that we've heard of many times in the Matsu. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank
okay.
you.
And Chris, before you start, we do have quite a number of people on my list here, so if you'd be so kind to keep it as brief as you can. I'm not trying to suppress you in any way, sir, but I'm going to suggest maybe 3 minutes, and if you don't feel that's enough time, you could talk to me after the meeting or submit written testimony, because I want to make sure that you feel like you're being heard adequately. But we have a lot of folks that we need to accommodate. So go ahead, sir.
I just was curious who is left in the room there.
Okay, we have several legislators here. We've got Representative Seaton, Kurtula, Rokeberg, Gatto, Stoltz, and myself. So there's about 6-7 of us still here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious if there was any going to be a consideration for further public testimony on these bills when other members of the committee might be present as well to hear it.
Yes, I do intend to. As a matter of fact, these bills are in their initial stages. They'll be evolving. There'll be some changes. And as I'd mentioned earlier, we're likely going to be combining these two bills into one. And then once we get to that point and do some further refining, then we will have some additional testimony and then take action as a committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. hoping to make some comments both on 420 and on 395. I just wanted to start introducing myself. I live in Palmer and am a constituent of Representative Stoltz's on Lazy Mountain. I live immediately adjacent to a Shell gas lease. I'm also a small business owner in Palmer and have served on the board of my community council on Lazy Mountain. And I currently serve as the board president to Friends of Matsu, a local nonprofit organization, citizens group that promotes land use planning, responsible development. We have a few 300 members currently. And that organization, Friends of Matsu, has been very active in the Colbert methane lease issue over the last 6 months, educating ourselves and the community about potential costs and benefits of these programs. I just became aware last week that there were 12,396 parcels in the Matsu with coal-bed methane leases on them. About 96% of those are privately held parcels, and they represent a value of approximately $815 million in taxable value. People obviously care about this issue a great deal and about the legislation before the committee that attempts to fix some of the egregious problems with the current gas leasing program. I know that in my community council area, two resolutions have been passed thus far encouraging both the buying back of the existing leases and the creation of an exclusion zone around our community to keep shallow gas from occurring there in the future. So people obviously are very concerned there. Last night I attended one of the five public work sessions that DNR is sponsoring to help create recommendations for new rules governing coal-bed methane. There were about 200 people there, crowded into the cafeteria at Thielen Middle School, and we all spent about 4 hours of our time grappling with the inherent conflicts resulting from this program, which is offering gas leases under private homes, neighborhoods, schools, and watersheds. With respect to House Bill 420 in particular, we feel that this legislation is, in its current form, doing little to protect property owners. The notification requirement called for is already in policy within DNR, and greater notification measures are actually going to be necessary from the public standpoint. Proper notice would include actual written notification to property owners prior to leasing being done, not prior to them being entered and drilled upon. The exaction provision is inadequate and encourages litigation. Several aspects of the bill are undefined and incomplete. The testing of wells, for instance, must take place in an unreasonable time frame after notice and at the public's own cost. Costs which I just briefly looked at, there probably would be in excess of $5 million to the 11,000 people who have private parcels and wells on those parcels in the Matsu that are currently leased. Other adjacent owners, meanwhile, would go unnoticed under this legislation and would be unable to even know if they needed to test their wells, therefore wouldn't have a claim. Collecting for damages still falls on the property owner to prove basically a huge burden for individual citizens to employ the expertise and to argue such a case. Few litigants outside in other developed basins have been successful in doing this, and I recognize that the commissioner would make that determination, and the language in the bill currently is may pay an owner. It should be mandatory, not left up to interpretation, in my view. This bill is currently inadequate in covering damages and is unnecessarily litigious, does little to provide any new notice to affected property owners. We do not support this bill in its current form. As far as House Bill 395 is concerned, this bill that's been put forth by Representative Scott Stoltz, Harris, and Seaton represents a good first step. It's something that we can at least put on the table and discuss and kick the tires, so to speak. We thank them for that. And there are several provisions within it that deserve mention, obviously. I'm not going to get too far into it, but just kind of stay brief as I can, and discussing just some of the highlights. With respect to Sections 5, 7, and 8, property rights, House Bill 395 needs to grant DNR the capacity to regulate CBM development and ensure that surface use agreements and surety bonds are negotiated before a lease is granted to protect the owner's negotiating position. 395 should also contain provisions giving surface owners adequate opportunity to seek and receive court damages without risking litigation costs. With respect to Section 1, the protection of drinking water, 395 takes a step toward protecting our water by allowing the state to regulate the reinjection of wastewater. However, this bill should require, not merely allow the state to regulate reinjection of water below known subsurface drinking and agricultural supplies. It should also go further and ban the use of toxic hydraulic fracturing fluids in the state of Alaska. With respect to Sections 2 and 4 on public notice, House Bill 395 does add limited public process requirements on leasing and development by expanding the newspaper requirements and local government notices. However, as I stated earlier, the public and overwhelmingly in the work sessions that are being conducted out here in the Valley are asking that the state notify individual landowners by mail so that there aren't communication conflicts or gaps, so that if you don't get the paper and don't look in the right place in the paper, that you miss notification that your land could be leased. Also, a more formal process with safeguards to address public concerns, provide for public hearing, should be a part of that. With respect to Sections 10 and 11, local government oversight, 395 repeals some of the more controversial provisions of House Bill 69, which we and the local government here, I think, would appreciate and support. The bill could be improved, however, by giving local municipalities the full authority to provide neighborhood setbacks, health and safety safeguards, noise abatement, and to help with some of the safety and health issues that have been brought up. It really should be in the hands of the municipalities to do that, and states outside are looking at this issue. We have litigated with industry about it and have found that local governments ought to have that jurisdiction in there. In their hands to be able to take control of those issues. With respect to Sections 3 and 6, compensation for facility siting, this would grant rental fees to service owners for companies siting wells or compressors on their land. Without a best interest finding preceding it, this approach, in my view, pits neighbors against one another. Granting rent to those landowners willing to sacrifice the use of their land without protecting adjacent landowners. For example, if a landowner who didn't have a home or a substantial investment in the land that they might own, they may just have a parcel, were to find the rent an interesting idea and want to receive rent for that, this would open up the possibility that they would be able to obviously take rent and help pay for their land, but adjacent landowners wouldn't necessarily be receiving anything for their damages or be receiving anything for the noise of a compressor, for instance, that would be bothering them because they had their home nearby. So I'm skeptical about the compensation in here, and I think that needs to be thought out a little bit further. There are some, obviously, some loopholes closed within narrowing the definition of coal bed methane and the depth at which it's done, and I think that especially for those tracks now down in Homer where conventional gas is being looked at and for elsewhere in Alaska where this would probably be done, I think this provision is excellent and well thought out.
Mr. Evans, I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir. You've been testifying for about 12 minutes. I'm not trying to, well, actually, I am cutting you off here, but not with any disrespect intended, but there are other folks that wish to testify.
Mr. Chairman, great. I apologize for going over my time.
That's okay. Go ahead and summarize if you would, please. Or are we finished now?
I just wanted to finish up, I guess, by just saying a few of the issues that Matthew citizens are concerned about that are not addressed in House Bill 395, and that would preeminently be a buyback of the existing leases up here to ensure equal application of this new legislation coming forward for all areas in the state. Application of a traditional oil gas development standards to coal bed methane development, including a best interest finding. And also a requirement that the Matthew Borough has asked for now in resolution form for baseline studies to be conducted and paid for by the state with respect to water quality. And I think that would address some of the issues brought up in your Bill 420. And methane seepage as well, just with the eye on public health and safety. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We'll move on to Robin McLean, who's a potter in Sutton. Robin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good to have you, Robin.
Thanks. I live in Sutton, as you know, and I'm on the Sutton Community Council. We've been working closely with the Buffalo Mine Community Council, which is in Representative Harris's district, and I wanted to thank his office and him especially for his concern on this issue and his help to his constituents in the area. I'm going to be speaking briefly on House Bill 395, and briefly just to say that we are very happy to see this bill coming our way and that the work is being done. We find lots of good provisions in this bill, and yet hopefully can add some things that will satisfy some of the our citizens' concerns. And we urge the committee to act on this bill sooner than later and hopefully make some changes that the citizens have been crying out for the last, many months. But anyway, I'm going to be forwarding my longer written comments to all the committee members, but here's a summary. We are very happy to see the AODCC may require reinjection of water. We would recommend that be a mandatory requirement, since that we've learned from the USGS that the water recharge for wells in the Mat-Su is 25 years. And to ensure the safety of our water over time, after the drilling operations are over and after the bonds are gone, we feel like the reinjection is the safest way to deal with the water and to put people's minds at ease. Additionally, we agree that since we know that Evergreen and other companies can do fracturing with non-toxic materials, that we hope that the state of Alaska would go with the highest common denominator and ask that only non-toxic fracturing fluids be used in our neighborhoods. I'm not going to go through all of my comments because I've got them in writing, but we do support, and the Community Council has passed resolutions asking for hydrological, geological, and methane seep studies prior to any drilling in our neighborhoods and areas where we live and have our investments in our property. Additionally, we hope very much that the committee will consider buyback of the leases or a buyback mechanism once these studies are done, because as we've been told through borough assembly work sessions with the AODCC and with geologists, that there are some areas that simply are geologically unsound for coal bed methane development, and that we're hoping that given those facts and those studies, that some areas can simply be determined not suitable and then bought back through the reasonable assessment of science and on a case-by-case basis. Additionally, we very much support the notion of increasing public notice for the leases prior to leasing, and the overwhelming consensus of the property owners is that the leasing must be notified by in person to the individual property owners. We thank you and we appreciate the public forum for your response. I think that's a great idea and encourage that and think that's a step in the right direction. Also, we also think that the reversal of the local control override from House Bill 69 is a very positive step that we think the community will support strongly. And then the various property rights provisions having to do with noise and setbacks we think are very good and need to be more specified in the legislation. I'll stop there so other people can speak, and thank you very much for letting us have this opportunity. We're hoping very much for good things to come out of this process.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate you taking time to testify, as well as you, Chris. Appreciate you coming down in an afternoon like this to bring your thoughts and suggestions on this legislation to the committee. I'm going to read couple names in advance here, so those that have been waiting online are aware that we do, in fact, have your names here. As a matter of fact, let me just go through the list of those that I have in front of me here. I've got Seth Little, Doug Stark, Mike McCarthy, Gene Walker, John Norman, Kevin Tabler, and I had actually several other sheets, but I realized that a lot of these were duplicate and triplicate names on here. So that's the extent of our list, and frankly, that's why I have not been actively enforcing the three-minute limit as a result of realizing that there are less people than I originally thought per the stack of papers that were thrust in front of me at the start of the meeting. So again, those that testify that feel they need to offer additional comments, you're welcome to submit those in writing to me or committee members. I'd be happy to provide you with the fax numbers, email addresses, so forth. And or you're welcome to give me a call as well. I'm at 800-468-2186 or 465-2186. We'll move to Seth Little of the Alaska Center for the Environment.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Thank you, Chair Coring, and members of the committee that are still there. I want to thank you for this opportunity to provide comments on House Bill 395 and House Bill 420, I'm here representing Alaska Center for the Environment, which is Alaska's largest homegrown conservation organization with over 8,000 dues-paying members statewide. We're glad to hear that this hearing is the beginning of an open and honest debate on how best to act to fix the problems with a system that is presently broken. The Oil and Gas Committee is the correct place to make these changes and have this open debate. I want to focus on the two bills for a second. House Bill 395 begins to provide is an appropriate vehicle for members of this committee to begin to resolve the coal bed methane mess that resulted after last year's ill-conceived coal bed methane legislation being House Bill 69. Alaskans across the state need this committee to act to provide relief. I urge the committee to please review the bill's provisions carefully and amending it as the public suggests. House Bill 420 is not a productive piece of legislation in its present form. The bill does not provide for pre-lease notification to landowners and puts the burden of proof on landowners to protect themselves should they be negatively impacted by development. While we recognize the need to develop our state's resources for the benefit of all Alaskans, we also understand the need to do it responsibly, which means that it must not impair our environment, must pay its own way, and have global support. Alaska's economy and Alaskans depend on the health of our unique environment. Coal bed methane in Alaska is a statewide issue. It's not an urban or a rural issue. While leases have already been issued in the Matsu Valley and Homer area, other areas of the state, including the Helena Basin, Huey area, and Kitchell Meridian, which includes the Red Dog Mine, have been identified as future coal bed methane hotspots. In actuality, most of the state of Alaska's subsurface rights for coal bed methane are open for lease applications on a first-come, first-served basis. So what we're seeing is a fragmented approach to dealing with a broken system. So in actuality, what we should be doing is having a statewide buyback and start from the beginning and doing it right, which would require the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to regulate the industry properly and require the Department of Natural Resources to develop regulations for development, not just guidelines. Coal bed methane development is much more than a drilling pad and a pump station. When development turns into production and the completed infrastructure will take its toll with compounding effects on Alaska's unique resources, wildlife habitat will be fragmented from roads and pipelines crisscrossing the landscape to access well sites, pump stations, compressor facilities, and power stations. Fish streams could be damaged by crossings and by siltation from road construction, and dust will impair air quality from increased traffic. Off-road vehicle access on new roads and pipeline easements will increase pressures on our fish and wildlife habitat. With the elimination of the best interest binding requirement, it is expected that there will be no analysis of the adverse environmental and social impacts from coal bed methane development, and encouraged to have that best interest binding a requirement. While most of the attention so far is focused on impacts to private property, as most of the leases have been issued underneath private property, public lands are also at risk. Those who recreate on our state's public lands could be affected by the infrastructure that production of coal bed methane will bring. I know there is already leases out in the Matthew Valley area below Hatcher Pass, which is a very popular recreational site for most of Valley and Anchorage residents. So I want to thank you for providing us with the opportunity to comment on these
questions for Mr. Little? Representative Roachberg has one for you.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Little, I'm a little bit, I'm not sure I quite understand why we should require a best interest finding for shallow gas when, in fact, we don't require that other than an updated existing BIF or best interest finding for conventional or deeper gas in the Cook Inlet Basin based on the area-wide leasing concept. Could you give me a justification of why we should have a best interest finding for shallow gas as opposed to conventional gas?
That's a question that I can look into further and get you a response back. I'd be happy to do that.
Now, Mr. Chairman, the reason I bring this up is I'm not sure people really understand the scope of what a best interest finding is. I mean, it sounds good, but, I mean, the work product and what has to be invested in that to create one that meets the standards are really quite substantial. And that's one of the reasons there was not, that was not part of the initial shallow gas concept, because we felt it would be an enormous barrier economically and a regulatory basis. That's not to say there shouldn't be some sideboards here, but, I mean, when people use the term best interest finding, the bet they should understand what that means.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Roachberg. And, Mr. Little, I just want you to know that in regard to House Bill 420, please recognize the good things that bill represents. First of all, it's not forcing anything on property owners. Secondly, it is establishing a fund that dollars could be drawn from to replace a well. So there's a that's the main thrust of that legislation, so please be mindful of that. As far as any minor flaws that might exist in that legislation, that's what we're here for as a committee to work through, though. So we've just simply presented a concept, and that is to create a fund that would replace water wells that that would potentially, albeit unlikely, go bad in the future. So, Mr. Little, thank you very much for your testimony.
Sure. Can I respond to?
Briefly, please.
As far as the HB 420, here's my understanding, and I think it was discussed earlier, that it's basically on the burden is on the landowner to get their water tested prior to drilling taking place, after they've been notified 30 days before drilling, and they will be coming on their property. And so that's what I was referring to.
Yes.
As far as that, you know, it's an attempt. I realize it's a beginning attempt to look at how to address with it, and I understand that, but also bring up the fact that is also a reality that landowners will then be incurring that cost. And I believe Representative Holm brought the issue up that, you know, maybe we should be having the companies that are going to be drilling near those homes to be paying for those studies.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Added to our list is Mark Myers, who's the Division of Oil and Gas Director. So if anybody at any point in time has any questions for him, you're certainly welcome to ask those. But we will get to Mark following the remaining testifiers here, the next of which is John Norman. John, are you there? John Norman? John, if you're there and you can't, or you can hear us, we can't hear you. So what we'll do, since...
John's out of the room. I'll go get him. It'll be just a second.
Sure. We'll go to the next individual. When John comes back, let us know, and then we'll get back to John. Okay, so the next individual is Doug Stark from Homer. Mr. Stark.
Thank you, gentlemen. My name is Dr. Doug Stark in Homer, and I've read over both of the bills, and I think 395 is really a good bill, and I'm in favor of it. As far as 420 goes, I'm interested in the well quantity and quality, and I would say that it's unreasonable to have the homeowners come up with those data again, and I would say that a reasonable way to do it would be any data they have from the time the well was drilled would basically establish the baseline. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Stark? Seeing none, we'll go back to John Norman. Mr. Norman, are you there?
What happened?
We're seeking John Norman.
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes. Loud and clear, sir.
Good. Well,
Well, I want to thank you very much for making us aware of the hearing and inviting us to listen and participate, and it's particularly helpful to hear the variety of comments. What I think, if you would agree, I think it might be best if we could reduce our comments to writing, and it might economize on the committee's time on both HB 395 and 420.
Good suggestion.
So we will do that, and we'll get those to you as expeditiously as possible. I have just a few quick thoughts here on 420. There's a reference to the fund to be established, and it references 4357, which is the old oil conservation fund. And there may be some historic artifacts out there in legislative history that by reusing this would create some confusion. And so it might be better to pick 43.59.020, but that's really a matter of how legislative drafting wants to codify it.
Thanks for the suggestion.
I have the same thought here again, just on the statute talks about the commissioner may pay, and that implies discretion, and perhaps that might answer the question about who determines this. If that were changed to shall, then it would make it a little more mandatory. Before the section where it says shall pay the owner for the costs, it may be advisable to put in reasonableness, a reasonable cost, to put some objective standard as opposed to whatever an actual cost might be that might be by a landowner. Continuing on the next page, there is a line that begins, well, and the activities appear to be probable, hydrologic, and I think activities might be clearer if it picked up the wording, the introductory wording of contamination or alteration, so that it would read, and the contamination or alteration appears to be probable, hydrologic consequences of the lessee's activities. We will comment. We had some other questions concerning the fund itself. It appears that it's to be built up to a total of $250,000, but then it does provide for refunds, apparently on a lease-by-lease basis. So what we were going to do is just run out some, run out some numbers, and then we'll offer those to you in our commentary. And several of the other speakers have pointed out the 20,000 MCF. And finally, again, a question about the concept of a refunding policy versus just creation of a fund. It clearly would require more administration to track a fund and then refund the money paid into it, as opposed to just having a surcharge. But the commission will think this through more than I have had time to do now, and then we'll try to offer you a considered opinion concerning how that might work. And with that, I think I'll stop and just say we are listening here, and all of the comments are accepted to be helpful to us, and we will promptly get our written comments into the committee.
Thank you very much, sir. The address here is State Capitol Building, Juneau 99801, just for the listeners, and we all have the same address, just as an FYI. Okay, we'll move to Mike McCarthy of the Kachemak Bay Property Owners Alliance. Mr. McCarthy. Mr. McCarthy, yes, sir, go ahead.
We're having some trouble here. Okay. I think we're okay now.
We hear you clearly, sir.
I'm representing over 800 members of the Kachemak Bay Property Owners Alliance in Homer.
How many members did you say, sir?
Over 800.
800?
I'm a constituent of Representative Seaton, and I'm a retired registered hard rock exploration geologist. I've practiced in Montana, Nevada, Arizona, the DNR hearings, I was, as well as a number of the audience members, extremely upset at the fact that I became a second-class citizen by virtue of the fact that I was denied due process of notification. And I would like to direct your attention to the aspect of the bill that sets a lower standard for the state of Alaska than the federal government has, namely the federal government Minerals Management Service has to notify in writing all persons affected by potential area-wide leases. The state should have the very same standard, that being written notification by mail to all property owners of record. I think that should be number one priority. Secondly, I've got a little bit of broken thought here because of the fact that I wasn't necessarily planning on addressing 420. I'll incorporate that, and I'll also follow this up with more detailed written comments. But as a former or retired geologist, I've dealt with mineral leases, and I was really shocked to learn that the state of Alaska sold 22,000 acres, or I should say leased 22,000 acres, for the trifling sum of $28,000. Now, outside states, that's a dollar per acre. Outside states have chastised their legislators for leasing land at $2 an acre. So I don't know how this price was arrived at, but it doesn't seem reasonable to me in view of the funding problems the state has had. The resource is worth more than a dollar an acre. The other thing is that dollar per acre doesn't come anywhere near the cost of potential harm to the individual property owner in case of restitution. There, going back to the Homer DNR meeting, there was absolutely no mention of methane hazards, such as methane seeps that are extremely prevalent in the winter. We have natural methane seeps right now, but if you take and examine your bill here, both 395 and the other, you will see there's no mention of pressures involved with hydraulic fracturing. It took me almost 2 months to find the figures. They vary between 1,000 and 10,000 pounds per square inch. And there is no ground, or hardly any ground, in this area of the state that will tolerate those kind of pressures without methane seeping through fractures that are naturally occurring or induced by the hydraulic fracturing pressure. And that is a very serious health concern for the folks here. I'll give you an example. I just got a name of the person that was burned yesterday, talking to one of the managers at Spinard Builder Supply. His mother is a personal friend of this person that was a victim. In about the late 50s, this individual was working on maintenance in the hospital well, and he went in, and they don't know if he flicked a switch or what it was, but at any rate, he and the door blew out of the well house. He received severe burns on his face and hand. His ring had to be cut off. That is a very real hazard, and people's basements and crawl spaces are subject to the same sort of methane, especially when it's subjected to hydraulic fracturing pressures. Another point, regulation should be statewide, and right now the way DNR is approaching the MATSU is inappropriate. We have statewide laws in effect for driver's licenses, for water quality, for air quality. It should be standard safety considerations that DNR develops across the state. The bond requirement is insufficient to protect private property and community drinking water. $500,000 will not cover the loss of property or potential hazard costs for landslides, mudslides, fires, etc. Alabama has a statute regarding non-toxic fracturing fluid. again, Alaska would be well advised to adopt that standard. The pending bills do not help the private property owner. They don't provide adequate notice before property is leased. They don't require the standards for regulating noise, setbacks, surface restoration, or other qualities that would protect water resources, quality of life, and the environment of property owners. The money that's collected for this bond needs to be increased substantially, because a five-year period is a reasonable period that this 420 bill is dealing with. But the money needs to be readily available over a long period of time, because you don't know how, as long as there's production going on, a hydraulic fracturing process can create well problems miles away, far more than 1,500 feet away from any given well. Finally here, as a final test for this legislation, I would strongly suggest that the bottom litmus test be what is best for Alaska. Public health and safety concerns and quality of life should all supersede corporate profits.
Thank you much, Mr. McCarthy. I was coughing as you were wrapping up. Did you say you were finished?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Really appreciate your testimony. Any questions from the members of the committee? For those that are listening online, there are representatives here from the MATSU as well as Homer. We've got Paul Seaton from the Homer area, just so you know, your representatives here listening to you. And we also have Representative Gatto and Stoltz that represent the MATSU for folks back in that area. Okay, and we also have a representative here from Harris's office. John is unable to be here due to another committee meeting commitment, but we have his one of his staff aides here, Rick. Your last name, Rick?
Vanderkoltz.
Thank you, Rick, and he's joined us at the table here. We've got three more individuals here to testify, and then we'll conclude the meeting, unless there's anybody out there that has not been called on my list here, and I definitely want to accommodate you folks if there are additional individuals. So when we get to the last name here, I'll ask for any additional testimony, and then we'll conclude the meeting. So we'll move now to Jean or Jeannie Walker of Homer. Ms. Walker, are you there?
Yes, I am, Chairman Corey.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Thanks for the opportunity to address you. I am a property owner and have property that's leased in our area. I was very pleased to see House Bill 95 and 420 under consideration, and I am represented by Mr. Seaton. I would like to, for this hearing, share just a couple comments related to the leasing process. I don't believe that these bills go far enough in terms of adequate notification. And one of the reasons I've come to this conclusion is because of what happened to me related to these leases. My husband and I bought a home in the Homer area last July. This was after the property had been leased in June for shallow gas development. Neither ourselves, the seller, or the realtor knew the property had been leased. And I believe this happened for two reasons. First, as you may know, is because no notification appeared in the local Homer papers. And second, because DNR is not required to record these leases. I believe that the bill should go further by having individual surface owners notified in writing before the land is leased. This could be done in a timely fashion so that they also could participate in a comment period. Then I believe that real estate transactions, at least the surface owner would know that the subsurface had been leased, and then the rules of full disclosure could apply. Secondly, I think the bill should also require that DNR develop the regulations and standards to review and possibly reject leases if a community situation, the geologic or environmental concerns, or public comments would warrant it. And lastly, I would just say that I am disappointed that House Bill 395 didn't And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. We have a question from Representative Gatto.
Mrs. Klein? Mrs.
Walker.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong page.
Walker.
Okay, sorry. In buying your property, did you get a title report?